La swallowed hard and found her voice. But it sure isn't the Zabrak. Plagueis was seated atop one of the smaller shipping containers when the hatch began to cycle. Fully awake since the Wobegon's jump to hyperspace, he had set still for the various scans the crew had run, and now lowered the hood of the lightweight and bloodied robe. When the hatch slid to, he found himself confronted by the ship's Togruta female captain, along with a muscular male Zabrak, a mottled Klaatuinian as tall as a normal mune, an Aqualish of the two-eyed variety, and a scarlet-hued, scaly-skinned Kalish, whose face resembled those of the bats Plagueis had consumed on Bald Demnik, and who was emitting an oleo of potent pheromones. All five carried blasters, but only the Klaatuinian's was primed for fire and leveled at Plagueis.
"You're not listed on the shipping manifest, stranger," Captain La said as she stepped into the bay, breath clouds emerging with the words.
Plagueis spread his hands in an innocent gesture.
"I confess to being a stowaway, Captain."
La approached guardedly, motioning to the open container a few meters away.
"How did you survive in there?"
Plagueis mimicked the wave of her hand.
"Those sea creatures make a comfortable bed."
The Zabrak surged forward, his stippled cranium furrowed in anger.
"Those creatures are how we make our living, Mjoln. And right now they're not worth a carking credit."
Plagueis locked eyes with him.
"I apologize for spoiling some of your cargo."
"The coolant," La said more harshly. "How did you survive that?"
"We Mjolns have three hearts," Plagueis said, crossing one leg over the other. "Two of them are under voluntary control, so I was able to keep my blood circulating and my body temperature close to normal."
Standing by the open container, the Quarra said,
"Speaking of blood, you're leaking some."
Plagueis saw that some of the sea creatures were coated with congealed blood.
"The result of an unfortunate accident, but thank you for noticing."
La shifted her gaze from the container to Plagueis.
"We have a medical droid. I'll have it take a look at your injury."
"That's very kind of you, Captain."
"You're a long way from the Braxent Run," the Kalish said. "And probably the last species we'd expect to find stowing away in a cargo container."
Plagueis nodded in agreement.
"I can well imagine."
"Khanir's spaceport has passenger flights to Bimisari," the Zabrak added. "You couldn't wait, or you're out of credits."
"To be honest, I wish to avoid the common spaceways."
La and the Zabrak traded dubious looks.
"Are you a fugitive?" she asked. "Wanted?"
Plagueis shook his head.
"I do, however, value my privacy."
"Well, you might,"
the Quarra said.
"But you have to admit,"
he motioned to the bloody sea creatures,
"this undermines your credibility, Sam. What brought you to Baldemic, Mjoln?"
the Klaatuinian asked before Plagueis could speak.
"I'm not at liberty to divulge the nature of my activities."
"Banking clan investments,"
the Klaatuinian said with a sneer.
"Or lawyering? That's all the Mjolns do, Captain."
La appraised Plagueis.
"Is he right?"
Plagueis shrugged.
"Not all of us are bankers or lawyers. No more than all Togrutas are pacifists."
"Be better for you if you were a financial wizard,"
the Zabrak said,
"to avoid being jettisoned from our ship."
Plagueis kept his eyes on La.
"Captain, I appreciate that you and your crew have many questions about me. But perhaps for the sake of simplicity, the two of us could speak privately for a moment?"
When she hesitated, he added,
"Strictly in the interest of facilitating an agreement."
La glanced at everyone, then set her jaw and nodded.
"I won't be long,"
she told the Zabrak as he was exiting the bay.
"But keep us on vid anyway."
The Zabrak shot Plagueis a gimlet stare as he spoke.
"If you are long, we'll be returning soon enough."
Plagueis waited until he and La were alone.
"Thank you, Captain."
She scowled.
"Enough of the polite jabber. Who are you? And why didn't you leave Baldemnik aboard whatever craft brought you there?"
Plagueis loosed an elaborate sigh.
"Before we go into any of that, suppose we assess the present situation squarely. I've stood away aboard your vessel in the hope of arranging quick passage to Munalist. Speaking in basic, Plagueis pronounced the word with a second N, silent. Fortunately for both of us, I'm in a position to reward you handsomely for transport. And of course, I'll cover the cost of whatever precious cargo I've ruined. You need only quote a reasonable price and the deal can be concluded. I assure you, Captain, that I am immune of my word. Her eyes narrowed in misgiving.
Leaving aside your identity for the moment, you know the important things. Your onward passage is a matter I'll have to take up with the crew.
Plagueis blinked in genuine confusion. I'm not sure I understand. You are the Wobegon's captain, are you not?
We're equals aboard this ship, Lars said. I don't make any major decisions without at least hearing everyone out. Whether those decisions involve the cargo we transport or where we deliver it. And while you're trying to make up your mind whether I'm noble or simply foolish, let me add that I don't care what you think of the arrangement. As you said, it's the situation. Plagueis smiled without showing his teeth.
In that case, Captain, I await the results of the summit.
La relaxed somewhat. You're going to have to sit tight in the meantime.
Plagueis took the conditions in stride. Take as much time as needed. The closer we get to Ithor, the closer I am to home.
The word stopped her cold. How do you know we're bound for Ithor?
The same way I know that your name is Elin La. Delighting in her confusion, Plagueis said, I'm not a telepath, Captain La. After I selected your ship from among those on the field, I sliced into Baldemnik's spaceport network.
She tilted her head in a mix of interest and unease. Why the Wobegon, then?
Plagueis sniffed. I don't gamble, Captain, unless I know that the odds of winning are on my side. She snorted. That's not gambling. In the main cabin space, 114D had been monitoring the conversation of the crew members since their return from Cargo Bay 4. The closest thing the Wobegon had to an actual medical specialist, the droid was responsible for the care and health of the crew, and so it had grown accustomed to eavesdropping on conversations whenever and wherever possible. Having created individual profiles based on heartbeat and breathing rates, body temperature and language, facial expression and vocalization, the droid understood that the discovery of a Mune intruder aboard the ship had significantly elevated Ma Kapp's stress level.
When have you ever known a Mune to do that?
The Zabrak was saying.
When have you ever known a Mune, period?
Wandao asked in kind.
All right, then. When have you ever heard about a Mune doing that?
Before Ma Kapp or anyone else could respond, the captain entered the cabin space, clearly confounded, though doing her best to disguise it. 114D noted increased blood flow in her head tails, which were themselves sensory organs, and a change in her pigmentation, a Togruta response to nervous tension that sometimes prompted involuntary mimetic camouflage.
So?
Ma Kapp said, coming to his feet. The crew members listened intently as Captain La summarized the short exchange she'd had with the Mune stowaway, who had refused to provide any personal details, not even his name. Nor had he offered explanation for his presence on Baldemnik, or divulged the reason behind his wanting to depart in haste. Most important, he had revealed nothing about the cause or nature of his injury. Instead, he had fixed on arranging a deal for passage to Munalinst, a world on the distant Braxton Run and corporate headquarters of the Intergalactic Banking Clan.
What's your gut telling you about him, Captain?
Pepe asked, his pointed ears twitching in curiosity. Captain La glanced back at the corridor that led to Cargo Bay 4.
He's as slick as they come, and used to getting his way. But either we take him back to Baldemnik and put our cargo at risk, or we drop him at our first stop and make him someone else's problem.
Or we just jettison him now,
Wendell said. La shook her head.
We don't know he didn't tell someone on Baldemnik that he was stowing away. And if he did, his disappearance could put us in serious muck.
What's it going to be, then?
Ma Kapp pressed.
La made her lips a thin line. I think we should get him off our hands as soon as possible. Wandao and Zuto exchanged glances.
You don't want to even discuss coming up with a price for passage?
I've never been on the Braxton Run, La said. Have any of you?
Head shook.
Is he willing to cover the cost of the spoiled cargo?
Pepe asked.
He said he would,
Then maybe we take him to Ithor,
the Kalish went on.
If he proves to be a cooperative passenger, we could consider taking him all the way to Munalist. Certainly wouldn't hurt to get familiar with that corner of space.
I don't know.
La took her lower lip between her teeth.
I'll go one step further, Zuto said, leading with his whiskered snout. I mean, this Mune could be a jackpot that's fallen right into our laps. Weren't you just saying that no bank would ever grant us a loan against the Wobegon? Well, Munalist is the bank, and this Mune can provide all the collateral we'll ever need.
A reward for years of leading clean lives,
Pepe added. La regarded the two of them.
Meaning what?
We hold him for ransom? Zuto drew in his tusks and shrugged.
We don't have to call it that.
Forget it, La said.
We've never done that.
Well, once maybe, but we're not about to do it again.
I agree, Markop said.
Wanda's head bobbed.
Same.
Pepe withdrew somewhat.
Okay, so I was just thinking out loud.
There's something else,
Markop said. Raising his big hand, he beckoned to 114D.
Tell the captain what you were telling us.
The droid moved to where the crew members were gathered and swiveled its round head toward La.
Captain, I merely pointed out that Munes are not known to travel unaccompanied without ample reasons for doing so. In fact, most Munes are reluctant to leave Munalist for any purpose other than to transact business negotiations.
That's exactly what I was saying about collateral,
Pepe interrupted.
There has to be some financial reason for his being on Baldemnik. Some major deal in the works we might be able to get in on. A construction project, maybe.
Let 4D finish, Markop said.
La looked at the droid.
Go ahead.
It has yet to be determined just what the Mune was involved in. Suppose, however, that the nature of his business is going to impact Baldemnik in a negative way. Should word spread that the crew of the Wobegon lend their support to the Mune's illegal departure, then what might become of the ship's reputation in the Aurel sector? You may wish to include the worth of that in your calculations regarding an arrangement for onward passage.
Markup folded his arms across his barrel chest.
Is our stowaway going to offer to set each of us up for life in case our services are no longer wanted in this sector?
What about what the Munes can do to us if we don't take him?
Zuto said.
They've got a reach as long as a galactic arm.
Mandal laughed without mirth.
What are they going to do? Downgrade our portfolios? Freeze our assets? Ruin our credit rating? Our only assets are this ship and our reputation for doing what we say we're going to do.
Mostly,
Markop said quietly. Pepe slapped his hands on his thighs.
Goes back to what I said about asking for a lot more than what he might see as a fair price. These banking clan types hold on to every credit. But we've got ourselves a live Mune. And no matter who he is or what he's pretending to be, I guarantee you he's worth more than 10 years of dealing in meat tails and octopods.
Markop broke the short silence.
Captain,
I'm not swayed by any of this, she said after a moment. I want him off our hands.
A look of puzzlement tugged at Zuto's features.
You think he's dangerous?
Pepe ridiculed the idea.
Munes are cowards, the lot of them. They use credits as weapons.
La took a long breath.
You asked for my gut reaction. That's what I'm giving you.
I've an idea, Markop said. A kind of compromise. We drop out of hyperspace and calm the authorities on Baldemnik. If this Mune's wanted for whatever reason, we return him, cargo or no. If not, we decide on a figure for taking him to Ithor and no farther.
He looked at La.
Are you willing to take that deal to him, Captain?
La responded as if her words had just caught up with her thoughts.
All right. That sounds reasonable.
But she remained seated.
Do you, want backup?
Wendell asked after another long moment had passed.
No, no, she said, finally getting to her feet. I'm the captain.
114D could almost hear her remind herself. Focusing its photoreceptors, it observed her right hand move discreetly to the blaster holstered on her hip, and with a flick of her thumb, she primed the weapon for fire.
"We're going to have to keep you on ice for a bit longer," La said when she entered the cargo bay.
Plagueis hadn't moved from the container that served as his seat, but his robe was parted and his hands rested on the tops of his knees. "Does that mean you failed to reach a consensus?"
"I wouldn't go that far," La said. "We've decided we need to know who you are before we agree to provide you with passage. And since you seem reluctant to tell us, we're going to check with Baldemnik."
Plagueis made his eyes dull with disappointment. "Captain, I've told you all you really need to know." The Wobegon lurched slightly.
"We're dropping out of hyperspace," La said.
In his mind, Plagueis heard Darth Tenebris say,
"To we who dwell in the Force, normal life is little more than pretense. Our only actions of significance are those we undertake in service to the dark side."
"I can't permit this, Captain," he told her. Her expression hardened.
"I'm afraid you'll have to."
He had been aware from the start of the conversation that her blaster was primed, and now her hand reached for it. Sharp canines glinted in her slightly open mouth. Had he truly believed that a deal could be arranged with the Wobegon's hot-tempered and immature crew members? Their fates had been sealed from the instant Plagueis had glimpsed the ship on the landing field. The possibility of reaching any other conclusion was fictional. From that first moment, all of them had been locked into an inevitable series of events. The Force had brought them together, into conflict. Even La must have sensed as much. Plagueis said,
"Don't, Captain."
But by then, the warning was nothing more than words. Chapter 4. The Meaning of Death. The Wobegon had just reverted to real space when 114D's audio sensors registered unusual sounds from aft. An activation click, a prolonged hiss of energy, a dopplering slash, a stuttering exhalation of breath. The sounds were followed by a sudden outpouring of heat from the corridor that accessed the cargo bays and what might have been interpreted as a gust of wind. Only by adjusting the input rate of its photoreceptors was the droid able to identify the blur that raced into the cabin space as a male Mune, dressed in a hooded robe, trousers, and soft boots that reached his shins. Makap, Pepe, Wandao, and Zuto turned in unison as the Mune came to a momentum-defying stop a few meters from where the four of them were seated. Clenched in his right hand was a crimson-bladed energy device the droid's databank recognized as a lightsaber, a weapon used almost exclusively by members of the Jedi Order. And yet the recognition prompted a moment of bewilderment. The Jedi were known to be guardians of peace and enforcers of justice. But the Mune's comportment, the set of his long limbs, the feral working of his jutting jaw, the yellow blaze in his eyes, suggested anything but peace. As for justice, 114D couldn't retrieve a single instance of the four crew members having performed an offense that warranted capital punishment. The humming lightsaber dangling from his left hand, the Mune remained silent, letting his posture speak for his nefarious intent. In turn, the crew members, realizing that they were being wrongly accused, clambered to their feet, reaching at the same time for the weapons strapped to their hips and thighs. That the Mune permitted them to do so furnished 114D with yet another mystery, at least until it realized that the Mune was merely courting combat. The droid wondered what Captain La could possibly have said or done to arouse so much wrath in the Mune. It replayed the memory of her priming the blaster. Had she decided that the problems the Mune presented for the Wobegon could best be solved by killing him, only to have misjudged him entirely? Regardless, it was apparent that the Mune believed the entire ship complicit in Captain La's actions and had decided to take it upon himself to mete out retribution of the cruelest sort.
114D assumed that this would include him, and instantly initiated a series of redundant routines that would back up and store data in order to provide a record of what was about to occur. The face-off tableau in the cabin space had endured for only a moment when Wendao, who had served as a bodyguard for a celebrated hut, leapt into action, drawing and firing his blaster even as he raced for cover behind one of the bulkheads. A split second behind, Markop raised his weapon and fired a continuous hail of blaster bolts at the Mune. In the same instant, Zuto and Pepe crouched low to the deck, sprang forward in an attempt to outflank their opponent and place him at the center of a deadly crossfire. From the passageway that led to the cockpit came the rapid footfalls of the pilot, Bleer, and the ship's Dresselian navigator, Simasali. 114D knew that they had been monitoring cam feeds of the cargo bay and thought it likely that they had witnessed whatever sentence the Mune had levied on Captain La. The Mune's reaction to the barrage of bolts that converged on him required almost more processing power than the droid had at its disposal. By employing a combination of body movements, lightsaber, and naked right hand, the agile sentient evaded, deflected, or returned every shot that targeted him. Slowly surrendering energy, the bolts caromed from the deck and bulkheads, touching off alarms, prompting a switch to emergency illumination, and unleashing cascades of fire-suppressant foam from the ceiling aerosols. No sooner had the Balasar and the Dresselian entered the cabin space than hatches sealed the corridors, preventing any escape from the melee. Only 114D's ability to calculate trajectories and react instantaneously to danger kept it from being on the receiving end of any of the numerous ricochets. Spying Bleer and Simasali, the Mune hurled the lightsaber in a spinning arc that took off the Balasar's antenna palps and scalp and most of the wrinkled Dresselian's left shoulder, misting the already agitated air with teal-colored blood. As alarms continued to wail and foam continued to gush, Bleer folded and fell face-first to the slickened deck, while Simasali, screeching in pain, collapsed to one side, reaching futilely for his severed arm with the other. The lightsaber had scarcely left the Mune's grip when Wendao flew from cover to bring the attack to the Mune, triggering his blaster as ceaselessly as Markop was still doing. This time, though, the Mune merely stretched out his right hand and absorbed the bolts. Traveling up the length of his arm and across his narrow chest, the energy seemed to fountain from the hand awaiting the return of the spinning weapon as a tangle of blue electricity that hissed from his tapered fingers, catching Wendao full on and lifting him to the ceiling of the hold before dropping him to the puddled deck in a heap, as if his bones had turned to dust. In strobing red light, Markop's eyes tracked the rise and fall of his broken comrade. His blaster depleted, the Zebrot drew a vibroblade from a belt sheath and launched himself at the Mune, his large right hand intent on fastening itself onto the Mune's spindly neck. The Mune caught the lightsaber, but instead of bringing it to bear against Markop, he danced and twirled out of reach of the vibroblade and commenced parrying the Zebrot's martial kicks and punches, until a sidekick to the thorax drove Markop clear across the cabin and slamming into the bulkhead. 114D's audio pickups registered the snap of the Zebrot's spine and the bursting of pulmonary arteries. Now Zuto and Pepe dived at the Mune from both sides and actually managed to get a hold on him. But it was as if the Mune had turned to stone. The Kalish and the Quara attacked with teeth and claws, but to no perceptible effect. And when the Mune had had enough of it, he positioned the lightsaber directly in front of him and gyred in their grasp, taking off Pepe's tusked face and Zuto's blunt, whiskered snout. 114D's olfactory sensors detected an outpouring of pheromones that signaled the death of the Kalish. Zuto, on the other hand, though gurgling blood and moaning in pain, could perhaps be saved if treated in time. Straightening out of a wide-legged stance, the Mune deactivated the lightsaber and scanned the beings he had killed and those he had maimed with chilling exactitude. His yellow eyes fell on 114D, but only for an instant. Then he fixed the lightsaber to his belt and went quickly to his nearest victim, who happened to be Duzuto. Dropping to one knee alongside him, the Mune gazed intently at the Quara's twitching body, but precisely at what, the droid couldn't surmise.
Zuto's bulging marine eyes seemed to implore his assailant for help, but the Mune did nothing to stanch the flow of blood or offer palliative aid. He remained by the quarry's side for a few moments, then moved quickly to Markap, from whose crushed chest cavity blood bubbled with each shallow breath. Again, the Mune ran his eyes over his victim, from Markop's tattooed face to his large feet. Eyes closed, the Mune adopted a posture that suggested intense concentration or meditation, and Markop snapped back to panic-stricken consciousness. 114D tuned into the Zabrok's pulse and found it regular, but only for a moment. Then the rhythm of Markop's heartbeat grew ragged and breaths began to stutter from his lungs. Soon he was dead. The Mune appeared to be frustrated, and his disappointment increased on finding that Blir was deceased as well. He spent only moments appraising Simisali before going to Wandao, who was conscious, though obviously paralyzed from the waist down.
"You dishonor your heritage and your weapon, Jedi,"
Wandao managed to say.
"You could have used the Force to compel us to do as you wished. I've not only seen that, but experienced it."
The Mune's face contorted in distaste. "If you've so little will," he said in the tongue of Wandao's species, "then you're of no use to me, Clatuinian," and ended Wandao's misery with a click of his thumb and middle finger. Gradually the spray from the ceiling abated, and the klaxons fell silent. His examinations completed, the Mune stood and turned slowly to the droid. "What name do you respond to?"
114D, sir.
"Can you pilot this ship, 114D?
"I can, sir."
The droid paused, then asked,
"Do you wish me to relocate the survivors to Medbay or jettison any of the corpses?"
The Mune surveyed his handiwork. "Leave them." He shrugged out of his sodden robe and hung it over a chair, revealing a second lightsaber affixed to his belt. "Captain La remarked that you have medical capabilities."
"I do, sir."
Turning his back to 114D, the Mune stripped his blood-stained tunic from his distended lower back. "Are you capable of repairing this?" The droid sharpened the focus of its photoreceptors and olfactory sensors.
"The wound shows signs of infection and putrefaction, sir, but yes, I can repair it."
The Mune lowered the tunic and retrieved a comlink from a pocket in the robe. Activating the device, he spent a moment inputting data, then turned the display so that 114D could read it. "Set a course for these coordinates, then attend to me in the captain's quarters."
"Anything else, sir?"
"Prepare food and drink. I'm famished." With the Wobegon traveling through hyperspace, Plagueis lay prone on the captain's bunk, a Bacta patch covering the wound on his back, contemplating the results of his attempts to prolong the lives of those crew members who had survived the altercation. Even where he had been successful in effecting repairs to damaged blood vessels and organs, the results had been temporary, as he had not been able to influence or appeal to the midichlorians to assist. Calling on the Force to mend ruptured arteries, torn muscle, or broken bone was no more difficult than levitating slabs of stone. But such refurbishments had little effect on a being's etheric shell, which was essentially the domain of the midichlorians, despite their physical presence in living cells. Among the ship's crew, the Togruta, Captain La, had been the strongest in the Force, but she was beyond his help by the time he reached her. Had it not been for sloppiness on his part, owing to fatigue and blood loss and lightning-fast reflexes on hers, the lightsaber might simply have pierced her neck and cervical spinal cord. But she had spun at the moment of impact, and the crimson blade had all but decapitated her. The Zabrak, too, had a slightly higher-than-normal midichlorian count, but not high enough to make him Force-sensitive. How different it had been to observe the behavior of the Zabrak's midichlorians compared with those of Darth Tenebris only 2 days earlier. The Jedi routinely perform blood tests to verify the midichlorian counts of prospective trainees, but Plagueis had passed beyond the need for such crude measurements. He could not only sense the strength of the Force in another, but also perceive the midichlorians that individualized forceful beings. It was that dark side ability that had allowed generations of Sith to locate and initiate recruits. The dispersal of midichlorians at the moment of physical death was, for lack of a better term,
inexorable. Analogous to his fated confrontation with the Wobegon crew, the moment of death appeared to be somehow fixed in space and time. According to his Sith education, since Captain La and the others had been in some sense dead from the moment Plagueis' gaze had alighted on the freighter, it followed that the midichlorians that resided in alleged symbiosis with them must have been preparing to be subsumed into the reservoir of life energy that was the Force long before Plagueis had stowed away. His attempts to save them, to prolong that state of symbiosis, were comparable to using a sponge to dam a raging river. And yet the Sith Lords of old were said to have been able to draw on the energies released during death to extend their own lives, as well as the lives of others. Unfortunately, much like the technique of essence transfer, that ancient knowledge had been lost. Feeling the ship revert to real space, Plagueis rose from the bunk, dressed, and walked forward. Stepping over the corpses sprawled in the main cabin, the deck plates awash in fire-suppressant fluid and blackening pools of blood, and through passageways reeking of death. One of the crew members, the now one-armed Dresselian, was still alive but comatose. In the ship's undermount cockpit, the droid stood motionless at the control console. Beyond the transparasteel viewport, myriad stars hung in space.
"Sir, we are approaching the coordinates supplied by your comlink,"
the droid said without turning from the view. Plagueis settled into the pilot's chair, which barely accommodated his long body.
"How do you come to be aboard the Wobegon, droid?"
"Formerly, I served the needs of a medical facility on Abroa Sky."
"In what capacity?"
"Research, in addition to performing a wide range of surgeries on beings of diverse species."
Plagueis regarded the droid.
"Thus your many appendages?"
"Yes, sir. But the ones I wear currently were retrofitted when I became the property of Captain La, so that I might better serve the needs of the Wobegon."
"And how did you become the captain's property?"
"I believe, sir, that I was awarded to Captain La in place of payments due for the receipt of certain merchandise. It is also my belief that the exchange was meant to be temporary."
"But Captain La decided to keep you."
"Yes, sir. She decided to keep me. I'm sorry to say that I am at a loss to explain her reasons, and I never presume to ask."
Plagueis nodded. "That's a good quality in a droid."
"I understand how it could be, sir."
"Tell me, droid, what is the possible consequence of low thaloxin levels in a Powan?"
114D didn't hesitate.
"One possible consequence would be an elevation of the oxidation rate, leading to the growth of an exophthalmic goiter, which in turn would affect the production of roemen from the anterior lobes of the luteary gland."
"And?"
"One result might be giantism, well beyond the power norm."
"If so?"
"The connecting ganglia, making up the autonomic nervous system and controlling glandular secretion, might induce an acceleration of the circular sphincter muscles of the digestive tract, resulting in xerophthalmia."
"So you are a diagnostician as well?"
"In a minor capacity, sir."
Beyond the viewport, growing larger against the backdrop of a behemoth-ringed planet, a space station turned in fixed orbit near a heavily cratered moon. A hodgepodge of interconnected domed modules, the station featured two long, boxy arms to which ships of varying size were tethered. Plagueis called data to the display screen of his comlink and placed it in view of 114D.
"Transmit this code over the comm."
The droid performed the task and waited at the comm while the cockpit enunciators crackled to life.
"Unidentified freighter, deep space demo and removal is in reception of your request. Give us a moment to authenticate your transmission."
"Holding fast while you authenticate," Plagueis said.
"Freighter, you are cleared for docking."
The voice returned a moment later.
"My ship," Plagueis said, leaning forward to take hold of the yoke.
As a precaution, the station directed them to a berth at the distal end of the larger of the two arms.
"You will accompany me into the landing bay," Plagueis told the droid when he had shut the ship down. "Raise the boarding ramp behind us and activate the anti-intrusion system. No one is to board the Wobegon unless I say otherwise."
"I understand, sir."
Waiting in the gloomy landing bay were a female Nikto and a russet-colored young male Doug, backed by a motley contingent of armed beings. Lowering the cowl of his robe as he approached, Plagueis saw the Nikto stiffen and signal those behind her to leave the area immediately.
"Magister Damask," she began in basic. "I had no foreknowledge,"
Plagueis cut her off.
This isn't a social call.
Of course, Magister. Regardless, do you wish me to apprise Boss Cabra of your visit?
Is he on station?
No, sir, but he can be reached by calm.
That won't be necessary, Plagueis said. I'll contact him myself.
As you wish, Magister. What services can the station provide?
Plagueis gestured in an offhanded way to the berthed freighter. This ship is to be sealed and slagged.
Without salvaging anything? The Dug said.
Plagueis looked at him.
I said sealed and slagged. Do you need to hear it a third time?
The Dug bared his teeth.
Do you know who you're talking to, Mune?
Plagueis cut his eyes to the nictoe.
Who is this callow pup? Pup?
The Dug repeated before the nictoe could intervene.
Boss Cabra's youngest progeny, Magister, she said quickly, restraining the Dug with her extended left arm. He means no disrespect.
Plagueis regarded the Dug again.
What are you called, pup?
The Dug's rear legs were tensed for a leap, but the nictoe whirled rapidly, slapping him across his flued and broad-nostrilled snout and clamping a hand on his windpipe.
Answer him!
She bellowed into his snarling face.
And with due respect!
The Dug relented and whimpered, though certainly more out of humiliation than pain.
Darnada!
He squeaked at last.
Darnada, Plagueis repeated before addressing the nictoe. Perhaps young Darnada should be muzzled to prevent him from endangering his father's business relationships.
His brashness reflects his inexperience, Magister,
the nictoe said in abject apology. She gave Darnada a menacing glance before continuing.
Trust that your orders regarding the ship will be honored in full, Magister.
I will also need a change of wardrobe and a fueled piloted ship.
Can we provide the pilot with a destination beforehand?
Munalist.
Of course, Magister. And what are your instructions regarding the droid?
Instructions?
Is the droid to be slagged along with the ship?
Plagueis looked over his shoulder at 114D.
How much of your memory can be wiped without tampering with your medical protocols?
I'm modular in design. My memory storage can be erased in its entirety or according to whatever parameters you establish.
Plagueis considered that.
Remain with the ship until it has been liquefied. I will expect a complete audio-vid recording.
114D raised its right-side appendages in a gesture of acknowledgement.
At your service, Magister Damask.
Chapter 5. Homecoming. Those fortunate enough to have visited Munalinst in the decades preceding the Clone Wars often remarked that the planet had been blessed with the most beautiful skies in the galaxy. To maintain that pristine blue realm, to prevent it from being sullied by dropships, shuttles, or landing craft, the Munes had erected the most costly skyhook of its kind anywhere outside the core. As efficient as it was luxurious, the skyhook, known affectionately as the Financial Funnel, linked the orbital city of Highport with the planetary capital, Harnaden, which functioned as the nerve center of the intergalactic banking clan. While the stately tower seemed to speak to the Mune's high regard for aesthetics and ecology, its true purpose was to keep visitors from setting foot on Munalinst, thereby safeguarding the planet's wealth of resources and keeping secret the lavish lifestyles of those who had ascended to the top of the food chain. From its remote corner of the outer rim, Munalinst exerted its influence across all of known space, and halfway to the galaxy's nearest satellite star cluster. Dating back to the founding of the Republic, the banking clan had funded governments, supported settlements, and bankrolled countless commerce guilds, trade corporations, and shipping cartels. In a very real sense, the IBC dictated the ebb and flow of wealth from the core to the outer rim. Scarcely a building was raised on Coruscant without the banking clan's approval. Scarcely a starship left the yards at Kuat or Vilbringi or Fondor without the IBC having brokered the deal. And scarcely an election occurred on Corellia or Kaminor without the Munes having been consulted. The Munes accomplished all these things with a meticulous serenity that belied the frenzied workings of their mathematical minds. Save for when it came to collecting on overdue debts, the Munes, on first acquaintance, appeared to be a stolid and lenient species, if somewhat arrogant, with an ascetic nature that was in full keeping with their willowy bodies and was reflected in the simple but harmonious architecture of their cities.
As pale as the Munes themselves, Highport's Space Center incorporated the design elements they favored most. Domed interiors, arch-topped windows, fluted columns, and unadorned friezes and entablatures. Among these faux stone building blocks, large groups of Munes maneuvered and mingled with unhurried if single-minded purpose, maintaining a conversational clamor that struck some visitors as reminiscent of the spoken language of thinking machines. Attending them were droids of all variety, and guest workers from the nearby worlds of Beskane, Jamus, Intrala, and others. On any given day, a visitor might spy envoys from Yagai, Gravlex Med, or Kali, along with huts of the Drixo or Proga kin. But what one saw most, in overwhelming numbers, were members of the banking clan. Financiers, accountants, lawyers, dressed in their signatory Palo fiduciary garb. Form-fitting green trousers and boots, round-collared green tunics, and flare-shouldered green cloaks. Some were accompanied by retinues of squat, dark-skinned, flat-nosed soldiers from the planet Iotra, sporting garish body armor and carrying ceremonial weapons. That day, cutting through the verdant sea like some predatory sea creature, came a wedge-shaped cluster of Munes, dressed in black cloaks and skullcaps, guarded by a contingent of tow-headed Ichani warriors, whose silver eyes darted vigilantly, and whose metallic bodysuits masked the translucency of their skin. At the leading edge of the wedge marched an elder Mune, with a whiskered chin and stooped shoulders, who was making directly for Highport's customs control station, where Higo Damask, as Plagueis was known to everyone but the late Darth Tenebris, and 114D were waiting, amid a contingent of security personnel.
"We came as soon as Highport Immigration notified us," Larsh Hill said. "If you had contacted us from Deep Space Demolition, we could have sent a ship, rather than have you rely on Bas Cabra's specious hospitality."
"No one seems to believe that I'm capable of finding my own way home," Damask said. Hill's long face wrinkled.
"I don't understand."
"It's not important that you do. Suffice it to say that your dispatching a ship would only have resulted in further delay."
Like Hill and his coterie of half a dozen, Damask's hairless head was encased in a tight-fitting bonnet, and the hem of his black coat swept the polished floor.
"You were expected days ago," Hill said with a note of exasperation.
"Events of an unforeseen nature prevented me from returning earlier."
"A successful journey, nevertheless, I assume?"
"You assume correctly."
Hill relaxed somewhat.
"We shouldn't tarry here any longer than necessary. Transport is waiting."
At Hill's gesture, the black-cloaked Munes began to angle toward the skyhook turbolifts, four of the silver-suited warriors falling in to flank Damask and the droid, which walked behind him.
"You're limping," Hill said in hushed urgency. "Are you injured?"
"Healing," Damask said. "Make no further mention of it."
"We could postpone the gathering."
"No. It will take place as scheduled."
"I'm relieved to hear that," Hill said, "since several of your guests are already in transit to Sojourn."
The group was halfway to the turbolifts when a faction of banking clan officials deliberately cut across their path, forcing them to halt. The faction's obvious leader, a Mune of middle age, separated himself from the rest and moved to the front.
"Magister Damask," he said, "what a surprise to encounter you here among the rabble."
Damask adopted a faint grin.
"Excluding yourself, of course, Chairman Toneth." Toneth stiffened.
"We're simply passing through."
"As are we," Damask said, motioning to Hill and the rest.
"You've been traveling, Magister."
"A business trip, Chairman."
"Of course."
It was Toneth's turn to show a weak smile.
"But in that case, perhaps you haven't heard that the Senate is on the verge of creating additional free trade zones in the Outer Rim territories. Despite what I understand were considerable efforts on your part, to the contrary, the shipping cartels face the danger of being broken, and even if not, will certainly have to deal with fierce competition from startup companies. Both Core and Outer Rim worlds should benefit greatly from the arrangement, wouldn't you agree?"
Damask inclined his head in a bow of acknowledgement.
"I hadn't heard, Magister. Whom can we thank for swaying the liberals to adopt the amendment?"
Among others, the Jedi Order lobbied successfully.
Then it must be for the best.
One would think,
Toneth said slowly,
save for the fact that, in exchange, the Trade Federation will now enjoy full voting privileges in the Senate.
Ah, well. Appeasements of one sort or another always figure into Senate affairs. Toneth leaned slightly toward Damask.
Thank you, however, for suggesting that we invest in Outer Rim and Trans-Perlemian shipping. The results provided a windfall.
Where and when I can be of service, Chairman? Toneth straightened.
Your clan father would be proud.
Damask looked Toneth in the eye. I take that as a compliment.
How else would I mean it, Magister?
When the banking clan members had moved off, and Damask's group was back in motion, Damask glanced at Hill.
Someday we will topple the Toneths from their lofty perch.
Hill smiled with his eyes.
I hope I'm alive to see that day. And just so you know, Higo, your father would be proud. Chairman Toneth's sarcasm notwithstanding.
You would know better than most.
Having arrived at the Skyhook turbolifts, Hill was motioning everyone but himself and Damask into a separate lift when Damask said,
The droid will ride with us.
Hill appraised 114D as the three of them entered the turbolift.
A new acquisition?
A door prize of sorts, Damask said. Hill didn't pursue it.
You'll be going to your residence or to Abora?
Directly to the island. The droid will accompany me.
I'll make the necessary arrangements.
Damask lowered his voice to ask,
Are we secure in here?
Completely.
Damask turned to face the taller Elder Mune. Rugis Gnome is dead.
The Bith?
Hill said in astonishment.
How? Where?
Of no relevance, Damask said, remembering.
Eventually Gnome's estate will pass to us, but that won't be for some time to come, since it's unlikely that his body will ever be found. Hill didn't bother asking for details.
We'll allow a standard year to pass. Then we'll petition the probate courts to render a decision, at the very least for whatever assets are contractually ours. You are the executor in any case, are you not?
Damask nodded.
Ultimately, we'll be liquidating most of the estate, but there are several antiques of a curious sort I plan to retain. I'll prepare an inventory. In the meantime, I want you to familiarize yourself with a world called Baldemnik. Once you have, you're to acquire mining rights for the entire northeast peninsula of the principal landmass. Purchase as much property as you can, from the shoreline to the central highlands. I'll provide you with specific coordinates.
Uncertainty tugged at Hill's strong features.
Are we venturing into the mining business now?
When the time is right. Use intermediaries who can't be traced to us. I suspect that you will have to go all the way to the top to secure what we need. The Indigenes will be troublesome to negotiate with, but I'm confident they can be persuaded. Bargain like you mean it. But in the end, spare no expense.
Baldemnik is that important?
A hunch, Damask said.
Descending rapidly, the Skyhook turbolift pierced layers of pure white clouds, revealing a curved panorama of aquamarine ocean, pale brown plains, and evergreen forest. And directly below, the view that was said to take one's breath away, the city of Harnaden, studded with neoclassical structures as towering as the volcanic spires that ringed it, and home to 50 million Munes, living in an urbanscape that was an orderly masterpiece of art and design. To some, it was the antithesis of most planetary capitals, the anti-Coruscant, the anti-Dinan.
What can we expect at the gathering? Damask asked, turning away from the view.
Gardula has requested an audience.
I'm not in the habit of sitting down with huts.
She asks your help in mediating a dispute.
With whom?
The Dasilogic clan.
Damask nodded knowingly. This has been brewing for some time. What else?
Representatives from Yinchor will be there.
Good. Holotransmissions have their limitations.
Members of the Trade Federation and the Grand Protectorate will also be attending.
Damask snorted.
There's no pleasing any of them.
He grew pensive, then said,
There's another small matter we need to settle. Extend a personal invitation to the owners of Subtext Mining.
Hill rubbed his whiskered chin.
I can't recall having engaged in dealings with them. Does this have anything to do with Baldemnik?
Damask ignored the question.
For a time, they advised Gnome. Make certain they understand that we operate in complete confidentiality.
If the Biff partnered with them, they must come highly recommended.
One would think.
Damask turned his back to Hill to take in the view once more.
But in fact, I don't see much future for them.
Unlike so many worlds that had been surveyed and settled by species from the core, Munalinst had given rise to its own brand of sentience. Farmers and fisherfolk, the ancient Munes hadn't known how favored their planet was until interstellar travel had become commonplace, and precious metals the backbone of the galactic economy. Had those early millennia of expansion not been a time of peace, the Munes might have lost what they had to military might. But as it happened, they had resisted all attempts at exploitation and become masters of their fate. Still, what was an economic blessing eventually became a burden. Once the Munes understood the value of what they had previously taken for granted, they held on to their riches with a ferocious tenacity and developed an almost agoraphobic attachment to their homeworld. In the midst of Munalinst's shallow oceans, the same volcanic activity that had fertilized the vast plains belched new seabed and precious metals enough to fuel the growth of empires. Mountains heaped up through vents in the planetary crust were found to be repositories of extraordinary wealth. Lapped by warm waters teeming with shellfish, tube worms, and bioluminescent flora, such smokers, as they were known, became both the source and the financial vaults of Munalinst's most powerful and prosperous clans. More remote than some, Abora, which had been the province of the Damask clan for several generations, was otherwise typical of the dormant smokers whose thickly forested conical peaks poked from the calm waters of the Western Sea. A maze of interconnected lava tubes ran deep into the mountain island. Waterfalls plunged from the sheer heights, and incense trees scented the salty air of the lowland valleys. Conveyed by speeder to Abora's North Tower complex, Plagueis escorted 114D on a tour of the corridors and caverns that constituted his place of sacrosanct solitude. Motioning to the many droids that were on hand to welcome the pair to Abora, Plagueis said,
You will come to find yourself at home here, as I have.
I'm certain I will, Magister Damask,
114D said, its photoreceptors registering a dozen different types of droids in a single glance. Memo droids, G&K power droids, even a prototype Ubrickian surgical droid.
In time we'll see to having your original appendages restored so that you can earn your keep.
I look forward to it, Magister.
The tour began in the outermost rooms, which were appointed with furnishings and objects of art of the highest quality, gathered from all sectors of the galaxy. But Plagueis was neither as acquisitive as a Nymordian, nor as ostentatious as a Hutt. And so the ornamented chambers quickly gave way to data-gathering rooms crowded with audio-vid receivers and holonet projectors, and then to galleries filled to overflowing with ancient documents and tomes, recorded on media ranging from tree-trunk parchment through flimsoplast to storage crystal and holocron. The Munes were said to abhor literature, and to loathe keeping records of anything other than loan notices, actuarial tables, and legal writs, and yet Plagueis was guardian of one of the finest libraries to be found anywhere outside of Roa Sky or the Jedi Temple on Coruscant. Here, neatly arranged and catalogued and stored in climate-controlled cases, was a collection of treatises and commentaries accumulated over centuries by the Sith and their often unwitting agents. Ancient histories of the Rakata and the Bajoon, texts devoted to the followers of Palawa, the Chaetos Academy, and the Order of Dai Bendu, archives that had once belonged to House Malro, Annals of the Sorcerers of Tund and of Queen Amanoa of Onderon. Biological studies of the Isalamiri and Vornskers of Mirkur and of the Tauzin of Vart. Certain long-lived species like the Wookies, Huts, Falin, and Toydarians were afforded galleries of their own. Deeper in the mountain were laboratories where Plagueis' real work took place. Confined to cages, stasis fields, bioreactors, and bacta tanks were life forms brought to Munalinst from across the galaxy, many from the galaxy's most remote worlds. Some were creatures of instinct, and others were semi-sentient. Some were immediately recognizable to 114D, others resembled creatures concocted from borrowed parts. Some were newly birthed or hatched, and some looked as if they were being kept at death's door. More than a few were the subjects of ongoing experiments in what seemed to be vivisection or interbreeding, and others were clearly in suspended animation. 114D noted that many of the animals wore remotes that linked them to biometric monitoring machines, while others were in the direct care of specialist droids. Elsewhere in the hollow of the mountain were sealed enclosures warmed by artificial light, a swirl with mixtures of rarefied gases and luxuriant with flora. And deeper still were test centers crammed with complex machines and glass-fronted cooling units devoted to the storage of chemical compounds, alkaloids derived from both plants and animals, blood and tissue samples, and bodily organs from a host of species. Plagueis instructed 114D to wander about the galleries and laboratories on his own and then report back to him. Hours later, the droid returned to say,
I recognize that you are involved in research related to species durability and hybridization, but I must confess to being unfamiliar with many of the examples of fauna and flora you have amassed, and few of the arcane documents in your library. Is the data available for upload?
Some portion of it, Plagueis said. The remainder will have to be scanned.
Then the task will require standard years, Magister.
I'm aware of that. While there is some urgency, we are in no rush.
I understand, sir. Is there specific data you wish me to assimilate first?
From the breast pocket of his cloak, Plagueis withdrew a storage crystal. Start with this. It is a history of the Sith. 114D took a moment to search its memory.
I have multiple listings under that heading. One defines the Sith as an ancient sect devoted to the study of the Force, similar to the Jedi, but guided by different principles.
That's close enough for now, Plagueis said.
Magister Damask, if I may be so bold as to inquire, what is our eventual goal?
The goal is to extend my life, indefinitely. To conquer death. The droid fixed Plagueis in its photoreceptors.
I have access to data on alleged elixirs of life and fountains of youth, Magister. But all living things ultimately die, do they not?
At present, 114D. The droid thought harder about it.
I have experience in organ replacement surgery, telomere genotherapy, and carbonite suspension, but nothing beyond that.
Plagueis' smooth upper lip curled.
Then you've merely scratched the surface.
With 114D deep in processing mode, Plagueis withdrew a vial of his own blood and subjected it to analysis. Despite the recent amplification of his powers, he sensed that his midichlorian count had not increased since the events on Baldemnik, and the analysis of the blood sample confirmed his suspicions. Research had long ago established that blood transfusions from force-sensitive individuals did not confer force powers to recipients, though blood with high midichlorian count could grant temporary strength and resiliency. Experiments in absolute transfusion had gone horribly awry for recipients, suggesting to some that the Force exacted a toll on those who attempted to tamper with it. An individual's midichlorians seemed to know to whom they belonged and become unresponsive outside their dedicated vessel. While midichlorians appeared to resist manipulation of a sort that might imperil the balance of the Force, they remained passive, even compliant, in the case of a weak-willed being manipulated by one who was strong in the Force. Perhaps that explained why it was often easier to call on the Force to heal someone other than oneself. Extending life, then, could hinge on something as simple as being able to induce midichlorians to create new cells, to subdivide at will, increasing their numbers into the tens of thousands to heal or replace damaged, aging, or metastatic cells. Midichlorians had to be compelled to survive.